When it comes to studying conflict, there are obvious data to examine. Spending on arms, the number of people killed or injured, the amount of land won or lost. What's harder to track are the indirect effects of conflict, the ways it produces deaths over time, or its impacts on public health. Researchers are trying to find ways to account for the sometimes less obvious impacts of conflict, and that's the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me, as always, is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Shaohui Tai, an Assistant Professor of Statistics in the University of California, Davis's Department of Statistics. Her research interests include the use of non-traditional data sources to study problems in data-scarce settings, with the current focus on global public health and estimating the consequences of violent conflict. She's the author of the Significance article, Counting the True Cost of War, which she's here to talk about today. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
How did conflict become something you were interested in as a researcher?
I would say it was during my postdoc that I got interested in this topic. So I was a postdoc at the School of Information at UC Berkeley, where I was working with a professor who had access to these different types of data. His name is Josh Blumenstock, who is a co-author on this particular paper that we're going to be talking about. And he works mainly in development economics, but he also had access to these mobile phone data in conflict-affected countries. And so, as we'll talk about, that became a very interesting source of data to work with in these sorts of settings. And as you already alluded to, it's very difficult to get good data in such settings, and the consequences of conflict are important to document, and it's not an easy thing to do. And so that's kind of what got me interested in this topic.
So in your paper, you mentioned, I mean, some striking summary of just how common conflict is.
Right.
So can you just as a little bit of background, tell us what are some of the forms of conflict that you might be investigating?
So conflict can take many forms. There's the all-out wars that you hear about so often in the news, but there's also many types of civil conflict within individual countries that take place between armed groups, between armed groups and the government, between social conflict over land disputes, things like that. And so the focus of this particular paper was the conflict in Afghanistan that, as you all know, went on for several decades. And so mainly the conflict involved the Taliban, who were insurgents, and government-related forces. So this is just one type of conflict that can be analyzed. There's, of course, many others.
I'm going to sort of build, I think, a little bit on John's question, just sort of simply ask, what are some of the, so like, I think obviously there, we understand what the direct impacts of conflict are, right? Mm-hmm. Casualties, you know, communities being erased. Your paper is examining the issue of like people who have been displaced from their homes. But before we get into that, I do wonder, what are some of the other kinds of indirect effects of conflict, and what are the struggles in measuring them?
Yeah, so I mean, there can be many kinds of social, economic, institutional effects that are not as easy to measure and document than the direct impact, which are the casualties and physical destruction. And so, for example, if we talk about casualties, so there's direct casualties due to, say, bombings or physical fighting, but there's also indirect casualties that come on later, for example, due to destruction of physical infrastructure or health infrastructure. So if hospitals are damaged, then people can't seek healthcare. And so you might see these effects later down the line. Also, if the water supplies are disrupted or people get displaced, they're in these vulnerable situations in which other types of diseases become more rampant. And so these are kind of indirect effects that you won't necessarily see immediately. Apart from death, there's also impacts to, for example, education. People's schooling get disrupted. And these have downstream effects as well, which could even be intergenerational, because if mothers are less well educated, then you see things like higher infant mortality rates in the next generation and so forth. And so these kind of impacts are much less easy to quantify compared to direct impacts.
You know, in looking at these direct versus indirect impacts, you know, I was thinking that just measurement of what's going on in a society implies that there's some infrastructure for doing that. I mean, national statistical offices do that, and I'm wondering if there's also in a lot of the countries where you're having conflict being observed, there's also not necessarily, even before the conflict emerged, a high degree of infrastructure to support this. So is that kind of, you know, really amplifying the challenge?
So that's actually a really good point. So a lot of these countries that are affected by conflict also tend to be lower and middle income countries, which don't have very well developed statistical infrastructure. And even in the absence of conflict, conducting surveys or censuses very time consuming and expensive. And so it's very difficult to collect good data even without conflict. Of course, this is exacerbated during times of conflict where, say, physical as well as statistical infrastructure is destroyed. There's physical insecurity, which makes it difficult for enumerators to go out and collect data. And also during conflict, there's displacement, which means that people are on the move. And so that makes them difficult to track down and collect data from. And so, in general, these are very tricky settings in which to collect data.
You mentioned the issue of displacement. So in your research, you were looking at internally displaced persons. And before we dive into that, I wondered if you could explain what's the difference between a refugee and an internally displaced person?
Forced displacement just means that people are forced to flee their homes or their places of usual residence. And so people can be displaced outside their own countries, which makes them refugees, or they could be displaced within the borders of their own country, which makes them internally displaced people. And so there's different types of reporting that is available for these different populations. If you're crossing a border, typically, there's some type of administrative reporting that is necessary. And so, this, in some sense, makes these refugees, more visible compared to internally displaced people. You often read about refugees along in the news, whereas you don't hear as much about internally displaced people because there's just not that kind of administrative reporting data. You're just going maybe to a relative's house in a different place in the country. And so, there's not any kind of administrative reporting that is necessary. And so you can collect data typically either using surveys or there's some limited reporting, for example, if you register for services or benefits. But of course, these data tend to be quite spotty.
So your study ends up using multiple data sources, not just the there's the sort of data source for where individuals are located, and we're going to ask you about that in a sec, but also you need to know where conflicts occurred and when conflicts occurred. So can you talk a little bit about that piece first?
Yeah, of course. So there is much better data on conflict events these days. There's a few particular data sources that empirical conflict researchers tend to use. The one that we use in this paper is collected by the Uppsala Conflict Data Program. And so the source of these data are media reports. And so they have a team of people scouring these media reports for information about when individual violent events occur. And so these could be like a single airstrike or like a suicide bombing or and so forth. And so these are individual events data. And we have information about specific locations as well in the form of GPS coordinates, as well as the time that it occurred. And so with these kind of granular individual level conflict events data, we're able to track conflict at a much finer, both granularity, both in time as well as in space.
So let's get to your data. So you're I'm realizing that I could be contributing to your data set now, just with the device that I'm holding in my hand. The listeners can't see it. I'm holding up my cell phone. So So this is telling a lot of people a lot of things about me, and I don't necessarily know. I actually I have a sense of that, but so talk a little bit about the kind of data that phones give you and how that led you to start trying to answer some questions about internal displacement.
Yeah, so basically, when you make a phone call, send a text message, or request a data packet from your phone, what happens is that, assuming you're not on Wi-Fi, you connect to the cell tower that is closest to you. And so, if we have the locations of these cell towers, then basically, what your phone is collecting is a data set of timestamps as well as locations of cell towers whenever you make such a transaction with your phone. And so if we interpolate and remove noise from these data, then we can approximately track a person's trajectory over time. And so in the data that we have, so we use these, we call this mobile phone metadata. It's basically collected for billing purposes. And so we have these data in Afghanistan over an approximately 4 year period. So they're all anonymized, but we are able to track about on the order of about 10 million subscribers. We have like 20 billion of such transactions. And based on those, interpolate their locations and so forth and aggregate them in a manner that helps us with our analysis.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and today we're talking about the cost of war with the University of California, Davis's Xiaohui Tai.
Okay, so now you're for each individual, just the few that you have, the only the 10 million that you're tracking. So you're gonna take you're inferring location based upon their proximity to a tower, and then you're going to say, okay, I want to define some. You need to define out migration for this person. You want to define for each of these people, have they been displaced in part in response to some event? So can you tell us a little bit about how did you define whether or not someone had been displaced?
Yeah, so actually this, so it uses this algorithm that is based on previous work. And so basically can think of it as like a scanning algorithm. So basically you have these intermittent locations of a person. And so perhaps they are in a single location for, say, a week, and then we see them in a different location, say on a Saturday and a Sunday, and then they come back on Monday, for example. And so in this particular paper, we don't actually want to consider short displacements like that. Maybe you're just going away for the weekend. And so what we're looking for are kind of longer stretches of time, roughly like a week-long period. So if you're going somewhere else for a week, then it's more plausible that you've been displaced somewhere as opposed to just like taking a trip on the weekend, for example. And so this is the way we kind of like smooth out the noise. And so what we do is we do this for every individual. And then we aggregate it to what we call a district level. And so a district in Afghanistan is like a county in the US. And so our analysis is conducted on this district level. And so when we talk about out migration, we refer to a person being in a different district or county over roughly a week-long period, and that's how we define migration in this particular paper. Of course, there's not really like a standard definition of migration or displacement that people use. For example, in some survey data that was collected in Afghanistan, the survey question about displacement was just, "Have you been displaced in the last year from your home?" And so it's not like there's a standardized definition that we could work with, and so we came up with something that seemed reasonable.
What time period were you looking at? And I guess, the question I think we probably both have is, what did you find?
Yeah, so we were looking at 2013 to 2017. And so basically, what we're interested in is, say there's a violent event happening in this district, do people react to it immediately? Or how soon do they react? As well as how long do the effects last? And so what we found was that there is an immediate impact of displacement due to these individual violent events. It peaks within about a week or so, and so the magnitude of the effect is it's roughly people are roughly 4% more likely to leave a district with a conflict event. And these effects are kind of persistent. And so even 3 to 4 months after such an event occurs, we do see that there is still higher likelihood of people being outside the district in which the event occurred, or although there is some decrease in the magnitude by that time.
You know, I'm curious if, you know, maybe this was not possible because of the fact that the observations were anonymized, but a sense of if there are differences between different demographic groups, there's, you know, I mean, maybe that's a future project, but I mean, I'm just curious if that was even possible.
So there's not any kind of like know your customer type requirements with these data. And so we don't have any demographic information on individuals, but we are able to do some work looking at differences in effects, for example, based on the type of violent event or the type of district that the event occurred in. And so there's some pretty interesting results there. For example, if the violent event was perpetrated by the Islamic State as compared to the Taliban, then we see a much larger displacement response. And that makes sense qualitatively because the Islamic State is seen as more like a terrorist organization. They do these like vivid displays of violence and so forth. Taliban is seen more as like a legitimate governing force in some parts of society. And so that result sends qualitatively. We also see effects based on location, where in what we call these provincial capitals, which are like the capitals of each, you can think of it as like a state capital. And so these are the local seats of government. There's higher presence of security forces. There's more aid being delivered. They tend to be more urban areas. And so when these provincial capitals experience a violent event, the displacement response is smaller compared to if violence happened in a more rural area. The other interesting thing is that if violence happens in a rural area, then people are more likely to flee to these provincial capitals. So these are some of the interesting things we were able to do because of the granularity of the data that we have.
You had so much data to work with. I wonder if during your analysis, there were things that you found that you thought were particularly surprising or interesting.
I think the most surprising thing we found was that there's this anticipatory reaction to violence. And so, if you look at a district, even before the violent event actually happened, you see people leaving beforehand, which seemed a little surprising to us. And when we dug into it a little bit more, we found like news reports, other qualitative evidence saying that the government forces actually warned civilians beforehand, before there was a large event that was going to take place. The Taliban also would inform the public through these things called night letters, where they post on like people's doors, informing them that there was going to be some violent event. Oh, and the other thing is that this data set only records fatal violent events. And so only when there's a fatality is that event going to be reported. Other types of events like troop movements or other types of like skirmishes, they would not be in this data set. And so another possibility is that there are all these other things happening in immediately before an actual event happens that are not being picked up in our data. And so those are some reasons why we might observe that anticipatory effect.
You know, I was curious about applying these ideas, the tools that you developed to different to other different conflict areas. You know, I was thinking about the war in Ukraine and certainly the internal displacement associated with that. I mean, do you think that, do you what do you imagine that this would generalize immediately to those other to another country's context?
So the the methods, I think, would generalize, but the findings, the specific substantive findings, might be more relevant to countries experiencing chronic conflict, such as Afghanistan, like a lower income context, or like a Muslim majority country, and so forth. But in terms of the methods, I think that could generalize. And I think a question that a lot of people have is, how easy is it to get access to these data, and what are some other options for getting similar data in a country such as Ukraine, for example? So there are actually many different avenues to get these types of data. So these large tech companies like Google, Facebook, Baidu, and so forth, during COVID, they started releasing these aggregate mobility data to track people's movements related to the stay-at-home orders and so forth. And so there are more publicly available sources that track movements. There's also data sets now from a mobility aggregator called Verisett. And so what this company Verisett does is they aggregate location information collected from different apps. So, whenever you let whatever app access your location, these locations are shared with aggregators. And so they're able to, in a similar way to what I described with the mobile phone metadata, they're able to pinpoint your location over time. And so this company is actually selling these types of aggregated data. And I've seen it being used in Ukraine, actually, to not to answer the specific question about internal displacement, but to look at the effect of warning systems on people's subsequent evacuation plans and so forth. And so that's another example of how these data has been used in Ukraine. Another interesting example I saw in Ukraine was people were trying to use satellite imagery of cars to see how people were being displaced within the country. And so people saw that, like, during the start of the war, people were going west. And so in the west side of the country, there was many more cars that were observed in the satellite imagery compared to in the east. And so there's many innovative things that people are trying to do with respect to measuring these types of movements.
I wish that you would be put out of business in terms of working on conflict, but I fear that you won't be. So what's kind of next for you? What's sort of the next project that you have a passion for exploring?
Yeah, so there's actually an extension of this particular paper that we've been working on, and hopefully that should be wrapping up soon. It looks at the effect of conflict on seasonal migration in Afghanistan. And so this seasonal migration is like labor migration related to agricultural work. And so the idea more generally is looking at labor market effects of armed conflict. And specifically, we look at the opium poppy cultivation industry in Afghanistan. So it's really interesting. Afghanistan is one of the world's largest producers of opium poppy, which is the raw material for heroin. And so a lot of these rural farmers are involved in this industry and very labor intensive. And so during the harvest, a lot of people go into these areas to help out with the harvest. And so the idea is we use these same types of mobile phone data. We know we use satellite imagery to determine the timing of the harvest. And so if we look at the mobile phone patterns during the time of the harvest, we can see if conflict changed that type of movement. And so that's another interesting project that we've been working on in this space.
Well, thank you so much for being here. That's all the time we have for this episode, Xiaowei Ti. Thank you so much again.
Thank
Thank
you.
you for having me.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.